This is the takeaway for Monday, July 11th, 2016.
This is the takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. Is this a war all of a sudden? Have we crossed the threshold in this country? That's all people were talking about on the steamy summer stoops this weekend in my neighborhood. The long, hot summer of 16 just getting started. And where is it all headed, people were asking.
Black people, we're not violent. We're not riotous people. We just want our voice to be heard. And for too long, people haven't listened to it.
It's important so people who are aware and our lawmakers are aware this is an important issue that can be swept under the rug and that we're here for justice.
Black people do need to be in these streets and we do need to be like protesting.
We let it die down. Another black man dead. We let it die down. Another black man dead.
Talk about it.
How many more? How many more?
This is a person with...
Are we suddenly looking at a war zone with battlefields popping up everywhere by surprise? Every American has to ask themselves that question. Have enough of us concluded that the police are systematically targeting blacks and people of color? Have enough of us concluded that the solution is to kill white people, as 25-year-old veteran Micah Johnson reportedly did in the weeks of planning leading up to the deliberate murders of five white officers in Dallas last week? There is more than enough anger in America right now, and people are stoking it.
When you say Black Lives Matter, that's inherently racist. Asian Lives Matter, Hispanic Lives Matter, that's anti-American and it's racist.
More than enough voices like the former mayor of New York City, Rudy Giuliani, taking sides, expressing outrage. There are more than enough guns, as we keep learning each week.
Those who pursue common sense improvement are beaten down. Reason is criticized. Obstruction is praised. Newtown. Rover, Charleston, Orlando. What is the tipping point?
And there is a ready-to-go narrative of racial warfare in America going back two centuries. Slave rebellions in New York City back in 1712 and 1741. John Brown's Reign of Terror, which was widely believed to be a plot by the North to create a race war in the South. In shooting President Lincoln, John Wilkes Booth claimed, quote, "This country was formed for the white, not for the black man," a theme picked up by the KKK in its angry, murderous, and garbled calls for white power. Then there were the Turner Diaries from 1978, a dreadfully written novel about a race war started to prevent the government from suspending the Constitution. The Turner Diaries seemed to inspire Timothy McVeigh's bombing of a federal building in 1995. Rhetoric of this kind and narratives of this kind come from all quarters. In 1967, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee did not seem so nonviolent.
I say violence is necessary. Violence is a part of America's culture. It is as American as cherry pie. American taught the black people to be violent. We will use that violence to rid ourselves of oppression if necessary.
That was SNCC leader and Black Panther Jameel Abdullah Al-Amin, also known as H-Rap Brown, delivering a message that very much paralleled the nonviolent protest message of African-American activists like Dr. Martin Luther King. The Black Lives Matter movement of today would be very recognizable to white and black activists of the 1960s, and it has attracted very familiar attacks from white public figures. Former Illinois lawmaker Joe Walsh at one point on Twitter over the weekend, "Three Dallas cops killed, seven wounded. This is now war. Watch out, Obama. Watch out, Black Lives Matter punks. Real America is coming after you." Walsh later deleted that tweet and said he did not mean it as a call for violence. Fox commentator Bill O'Reilly insisted on his program that most whites don't support Black Lives Matter. The head of the National Association of Police Organizations accused President Obama of being responsible for a war on cops. The president has cut short his European trip, will speak tomorrow at the memorial service for the Dallas cops, and has also condemned the recent police shootings of civilians in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, and St. Paul, Minnesota. In the words of a very brave and emotional Dallas police chief, David Brown, "All I know is this must stop." Is this the edge of something like a race war? Stanley Nelson is a documentary film director and MacArthur Fellow. His most recent film is The Black Panthers, Vanguard of the Revolution. Stanley Nelson, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thank you so much.
Do you feel as though we're on the edge of something here and that there is a narrative ready to go if enough people decide to engage?
Well, I hope we're on the edge of something. I think that we may be on the edge of something good. I think that people
are looking at police violence, people are looking at racism in a different way than they were certainly even 3 days ago.
How would we know one way or another? And how did people know back in the 60s which direction things were headed?
Well, I think one thing that's important to remember about the 60s is that, you know, it was a movement not only of African Americans, but it was a movement of all people. You know, if you look at any of the huge marches, it's not just Black Americans, it's white Americans, Asians, Latinos. Everybody is participating. And I think just as today, you know, everybody's outraged by what's going on. And I hope that, you know, we are at the start of a movement.
Although back in the 60s, it seemed as though presidential candidates, political leaders, political institutions were directly engaged in what was going on in the conversation about race in America. Certainly President Obama is engaged, but he's not, you know, he's an outgoing president. I don't see the presidential candidates engaged. This seems to be a sideshow to the American political theater in 2016.
You know, I think it takes a moment for any candidate to become involved. But I think it's really important that you know, we speak honestly about what's going on. You know, Donald Trump has fanned the flames of racism in this country. You know, for African Americans, you know, he was a real driving force in the birther movement. He started out his campaign by calling Mexicans rapists. He's called for banning Muslims from this country. And so there's this feeling that, you know, we're under attack. And at the same time, other Republicans are saying, yeah, well, yeah, that's racist, but we'll still support him. You know, it's very scary, I think, for African Americans to look out and say Donald Trump has over 50% of the white male vote. So, you know, we walk down the street, we look at two white men and say one of them is going to vote for Donald Trump, who is really spouting racist rhetoric constantly.
As unfortunate as that rhetoric is, it also seems as though that is disconnected from the facts of what's going on over the last couple of years in the United States. You know, video didn't invent the police shootings. If that is the case, I mean, there does have to be some more direct engagement by political leaders about what is the function of cops than just, you know, the kinds of superficial rhetoric of Donald Trump, as unfortunate as it is, and what Hillary Clinton is saying about we have to come together. It's got to be more detailed and concrete than that, it seems.
You know, everybody is struggling to figure out what is going on, and I don't think there are any, you know, clear, quick answers. I think that there's a feeling that there's a culture in the police department that has to change. And how do you change a culture? You know, I think one of the most, you know, startling things that's happened is that these, you know, killings have gone on in every sector of the country. It's not just one place, you know, it's not just the South, it's not just the North, it's not just the East. So, you know, what does that say about police departments? I think that you're right, that you know, the difference is that people have a camera in their pocket, you know, and they're able to film these things. And so that's what's changed the way we look at it, because we now have been able to see it, and it's impossible to deny.
I was talking with people in my neighborhood over the weekend, and, you know, the thing that really disturbed me was a sense that we have a much narrower margin for error right now, that there's not a lot of slack in terms of what could trigger events in a very unpredictable way. One person said to me that we're just two Micah Johnsons away from martial law in this country, and I just didn't know what to say to that.
I hope that we're not that close, but, you know, I think that we are, again, at an extraordinary time, that you have, you know, a Republican candidate for the presidency of the United States, or presumptive Republican nominee for the presidency, who is spouting very, very inflammatory and racist statements, and that's fanning the flames of where we are. And I think it's important to understand that, you know, in my lifetime, I've never seen any candidate like this. And so I think that's one of the things that seems like it's really pulling us apart, because you have, you know, a huge portion of the country, 40% at the very least, that is going to vote for this man. And I think it's shocking to so many people, because we're not the country that so many of us thought we were.
Is race war an old story in America, and is it a narrative that comes right off the shelf if people want to go there? And if they don't want to go there, in their local neighborhoods, what do they do?
I don't think we're at a place where race war is really a possibility. I don't think it's ever really been a possibility. I think we're at a place, hopefully, where change is something that people are thinking about. You know, that black people and white people, Asian, Latino, everybody in this country is thinking about how do we get better? I mean, that's one of the things that the United States offers, you know, is the chance to get better. And how is it not just kind of a black and white issue? You know, that's what's also shocking, I think, in some ways to me and African Americans, you know, you see a black person, you know, murdered, and it's a black issue. It's not a black issue. It's an issue for all of us.
And do you see people opting out of this rhetoric and deciding to express solidarity in their own communities, black and white?
Yeah, I do. I mean, I am very heartened by young people. You know, when you look at these demonstrations that are taking place all over the country, you know, it's not just black people. It's everybody who's protesting. And I think that's what we have to understand, that, you know, this has to be everybody who protests these police killings that have gone on, you know, over and over again. And for the last 2 years, you know, because of video cameras that we have in our pockets, we've seen evidence that this is really happening. You know, irrefutable evidence. Before, we could kind of pass it off. Oh, he had a gun. Oh, he must have been doing something wrong. Oh, there must have been something. We can't do that now. And I think it's important for all of us as Americans to stand up and say, wait a minute, this has to stop.
Before we go, why did the civil rights movement choose a nonviolent path in the 60s, or seemingly chose a nonviolent path when there were so many other options in the 1960s?
Well, I mean, I think obviously, you know, nonviolence is the only way you can win. I mean, you know, African Americans are what, you know, 1/12 of the population or something like that. You know, we can't win a war. You know, it's not a war. You know, we're not, you know, we're Americans. We're not against, you know, we're not fighting against the government. We're fighting for the government to change and be supportive and support all Americans. That's what the civil rights movement was about. Part of what the civil rights movement said, the very idea of the civil rights movement and the nonviolence, was to say, look at what's happening in the South. Look at the dogs, look at the hoses. Okay, you have to pick a side. And I think that's what maybe where we're coming to now. And I think that is maybe not a bad moment. Maybe it's a moment of change.
Stanley Nelson is a documentary film director and MacArthur Fellow. His most recent film is The Black Panthers, Vanguard of the Revolution. Thanks so much, Stanley.
Thank you so much.
The killing needs to stop, all of it. None of these shootings were justified. Not the shootings of the police, not the shootings by the police. That's a statement from the surprising high-polling Libertarian Party on the violence of the past week. The frustration in the black community is palpable and frankly justified, the statement from the Libertarian says. When rogue cop after rogue cop gets off scot-free after using excessive force and changes are not made and consequences are not felt, it causes this horrible tension we're feeling today. The shooters in Dallas will see justice, but will the blue wall of silence ever be broken? Will cops ever start to do a better job of policing themselves? The Libertarian Party calls for peace and justice. Those two things go hand in hand. Libertarian presidential candidate Gary Johnson is surprisingly relevant this year. He needs 15% of polled public support to make it on the debate stage with Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump this fall. In an election year where voters are looking for options and a new path for this country's government, 15% may just be enough to determine this presidential contest.
Well, right now there's this consensus number that we're at 10%. And when I say we, you know, I am running with Bill Weld, former governor of Massachusetts, which I think has lent a lot of credibility to this also. We're just trying to guide a pathway right down the middle here, given that Trump and Clinton, arguably the two most polarizing figures that have ever run for this office.
And when you say polarizing figures, Trump is in one world, but Hillary definitely represents a kind of centrist, it would seem, policy outlook in any case.
Well, I'm going to argue that we're probably more centrist than Hillary, and Hillary being, you know, government has the answer to everything. And then look, it hasn't been intentional, but foreign policy, when you go in and you when you back the moderate or the insurgents in Syria and Libya, and those insurgents are aligned with ISIS and Al-Qaeda, that's not purposeful, but can't make it up. That's what's happened. When it comes to foreign policy, I don't know what changes with Hillary going forward. The Pentagon itself says that we could reduce U.S. bases by 20%, but that hasn't happened because congressmen and women, senators from those states, won't allow that to happen.
On the finance front, on the domestic policy front, do you support a massive reduction in taxes?
As president, I'm going to sign legislation that reduces taxes, makes it simpler, makes it more fair. If I could wave a magic wand, John, I would eliminate income tax. I would eliminate corporate tax. Because we would do that, we could also abolish the IRS. And I would replace all of that with one federal consumption tax, which I think would be very fair. And you could look at the FAIR tax, which is a proposal right now, a piece of legislation before Congress on how to dot the I's and cross the T's on how you accomplish one federal consumption tax.
How do you reconcile your position on women's reproductive rights as far as health care is concerned, otherwise known as the abortion question?
Well, I support a woman's right to choose. I think I don't think there's a more difficult decision in anyone's life, but who should be making that decision? I think that's the woman involved that needs to make that decision. I think that people don't realize that Roe v. Wade is not the law of the land, that Casey versus Planned Parenthood is, and Casey versus Planned Parenthood says that a woman has the right to have an abortion up to the viability of the fetus, and the Supreme Court defines viability of the fetus as being able to sustain the life of the fetus outside of the womb, even if by artificial means. That's the current law of the land.
Are you opposed to that?
No. I think it mere. I hate to say where my position is on the issue because I so fervently believe that this is a woman's choice, period.
What about climate change?
I believe climate change is man-caused, and a great example of climate change and our reacting to it, if that's the right word, is that we're demanding less CO2 emission as consumers, and so effectively coal has been bankrupted. Coal is at an unbelievably low price, and at that low price, natural gas is even cheaper. So there's no new coal plants that are going to be built. They're all going to go out of existence. And, of course, that currently amounts to 37% of the load, but it's going away.
If you are elected at the inaugural, will there be cannabis edibles?
No, probably not, John.
So you've already had that meeting? You've already had that meeting.
No, I haven't had that meeting. But I am planning to do away with the imperial presidency, so I don't know what the inauguration is going to look like. It's going to be a really scaled-back affair.
Do you believe that legalization of marijuana constitutes a kind of symbolic example of what libertarians want in terms of government staying out of people's lives?
I think it's the perfect example of symbolically what libertarians stand for, which is you and I as individuals being able to make choices in our own lives as long as those choices don't adversely affect others.
The question you've been asked probably most often is, what if you deny enough votes from the Democrats to give Donald Trump a victory in November?
I think the party needs to be crashed, and I hope to occupy that role. And right now, 50% of voters that are registering to vote are voting as registering as independent. Well, where's that representation? Speaking with a broad brushstroke, I think most people are libertarian. It's just that they don't know it. And that's, hey, being fiscally conservative, socially, who cares as long as you don't force it on me? And then let's stop with these military interventions that are having the unintended consequence of making things worse, not better.
Gary Johnson, former governor of New Mexico and libertarian candidate for president of the United States. Thank you so much.
John, great being with you. Thank you.
Here's a bit of irresistible tech lore that actually references the civil rights history we were talking about earlier in the hour. It seems that MIT engineers from the 1960s, who originally wrote the thousands of literal lines of code for the original Apollo mission, left some graffiti in the fine print on the way to the moon. Secret messages in the form of snarky comments buried between command lines controlling the lunar spacecraft. So when the computer code used in the Apollo moon missions was uploaded to a popular programming website last week, the wider world of programmers began sharing the paleo-snarky tidbits. Keith Collins, a reporter with Quartz, said there is a mood of celebration in the programmer world this week.
Programmers, when they started dissecting this code, were so interested in the comments because it's just the most readable thing. It kind of explains what's going on. And what they found is that there were a lot of comments that weren't just explaining what was going on, but were actually jokes and references to what was going on at the time. One of my favorites was they had a subroutine file that was called Burn Baby Burn.
Thank you. Yeah. Yeah. Just what we need. Yeah. Yeah.
And in the code, there was an introduction to that. And I think the introduction comments were added a little later. But they explained there was a radio DJ. The L.A. riots were going on at the time. And when a radio DJ would in L.A. would play the new hot record, they would say, "Burn, baby, burn." People working on this software said, you know, we were reading the news. We knew what was going on, although we were in the lab all the time. And that routine that's named Burn Baby Burn is the master ignition routine.
It's amazing. I mean, how you close the arc of the violence that was taking place right then
yeah.
and what we got going on now. And then, of course, there are just joke references, Shakespeare and Easter, because I guess they were doing a lot of programming in the spring.
Oh, yeah. They referenced a Shakespeare quote. I have it here if you want me to.
Oh, sure.
It's a Shakespeare quote that mentions nouns and verbs. The reason that they used the quote, presumably, is that the programming language that they created used a structure of nouns and verbs to say a verb would be run program and a noun would be something like time to ignition. There's this really funny part. My very favorite is this is all within comments. The comment is addressing the astronaut. So it says, "Astronaut, colon, please crank the silly thing around." And then the next line says, "Terminate." And the next line says, "Proceed, see if he's lying." And then the next line says, "Enter initialize landing radar." And then that section closes with, "Off to see the wizard." and Ron Berkey, who transcribed this code, explained to me that code is about positioning the antenna for the lunar module. This code was written such a long time ago, and has actually been available online for quite a while. The fact that simply by putting it on this new platform where people where programmers tend to congregate today, it really, you know, it just exploded online as soon as it was put on there. People started dissecting these comments and finding interesting bits. And I think a really interesting thing about this is that now, all this time later, it still kind of inspires this awe. You know, this is the code that brought us to the moon. This is, you might not understand it when you look at the code itself, but, you know, we have these comments. And even all this time later, people look at this and say, wow, you know, this is available to me. This is this historic sort of artifact, and now the whole world has access to it.
And thousands of miles of code, or thousands of lines of code.
That's right.
Is it the case that a typical upload of an Instagram file from a 14-year-old is millions of lines of code?
I don't know.
Maybe.
Well, Instagram itself is probably many more lines of code than this is. And yeah, they did a lot of work with very little space. One programmer has worked out that an iPhone, which we all carry around in our pockets today, could have run the software for 120 million Apollo missions.
Keith Collins, a reporter for Quartz. Thanks so much.
Thank you, John.
Support for The Takeaway comes from Staples, offering printer ink and toner cartridges for home or business printers, and in-store print shops that can create customized presentations, booklets, and manuals. At Staples stores or staples.com. Staples, make more happen. The Henry Luce Foundation, for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. The Takeaway's resilience reporting is supported by the Rockefeller Foundation. For more, go to rockfound.org.
Science writer Carl Zimmer has quite a summer reading task in front of him. The 3,234.83 mega base pairs in his own personal genome. Zimmer got his personal DNA fully sequenced, and that's a serious bit of science. Carl, does this cost a lot of money?
Well, relatively speaking, it's pretty dirt cheap. My own genome cost around $3,000 to get sequenced. There are some companies that are now already promising to do it for less than $1,000.
And you can expense that to STAT, which is the article that you've published a journey of learning your genome in, the first part of which is out this week, right?
That's right. STAT was very kind in supporting this project, which has kind of evolved into a big three-part series. The first part is published today, and then two more will be published next Monday and the Monday after.
Now, what do you get when you get your DNA fully sequenced? A handsome, you know, suitable for framing, bound something or other that I guess you'd have to be a biologist to know what the heck it is, right?
Well, yeah, if you printed out the whole human genome, your genome, for example, in books, like paper books, you could fill several bookshelves with it, and you would be spending a long time studying it. What I got, in which I quite love, is a very sleek silver external hard drive with 70 gigabytes of data on it. And that's all the raw data from a process of reading my DNA. And from that, you can assemble my whole genome.
Now, does it say – I mean, this is – I'll start with stupid questions first. I mean, does it indicate in there that you're a journalist?
The journalism gene has yet to be found, I'm afraid.
Right. But, I mean, are there traits, are there aspects of your life that you could tangibly identify now that are related to this genome? We understand, of course, that the genome is the template for creating amino acids and proteins, right, that then are assembled into tissues, et cetera.
Right. I mean, we start out as fertilized eggs with genomes, and from all that, we emerge into the interaction of our genomes with our environments. So it's pretty important. Genomes sometimes tell you something you already knew. Like, for example, my genome has a Y chromosome. Apparently, I'm a guy. So, okay, got that established. Wow. Fine.
For but just $3,000. $3,000. That's all it took. Wow.
Well, you need to dig deeper to find the really surprising things. So, for example, you can find, for example, if you're a non-African, you can find the individual genes that you inherited from Neanderthals, just for starters. You can find genes that actually protect you from diseases instead of raising your risk of them. It's like an amazing continent that you can explore once you get all that data and get some help from scientists to figure out where you're going and what it all means.
In many ways, the value of this is not so much in what you can decipher now, but in the future, as discoveries and epigenetic sorts of phenomenon are discovered as related to the genome, you can actually go to this reference source and figure out what implications there are for you in all of this, right?
Well, there's an ongoing debate about what the role of genome sequencing should be in medicine. Right now, human genome sequencing is mostly done just for research or in cases where people have some sort of disorder that is just, they can't get diagnosed properly. And so people talk about what's called a diagnostic odyssey. Sometimes you have to sequence the whole genome to find the problem with somebody on a genetic basis. If you're healthy, do you need your genome sequence? Well, you might actually discover some rare mutation that might actually affect your own health or the health of your children down the line. But, a lot of the times you don't. I mean, I can't say that I've learned anything currently from my genome that's going to really change the way I live my life. But in the future, some of these mysterious mutations where scientists can't really tell me what they mean, they might turn out to reveal something. So, I can hold on to this data and revisit it maybe in 5-10 years and see what people have found.
You write about this a little bit in your article, but you have that hard drive just sitting there on your desk. How what's it feel like? I mean, what happens?
It's pretty cool, like just to look at it and say, like, wow, there it all is. And
that's
this
you.
Is something that, well, you know, that I'm not going to try to make, my genome equivalent to me, but that's, that's my cookbook, I like to think. And that is something that was literally impossible for a person, like me, billion to have just a couple years ago. I mean, it's just, it's astonishing. It's sort of a testament to the advance of science that it can just be sitting there. And then scientists now can show me so much about my genome by opening it up and taking a tour and saying, look, here's a huge area of DNA that you accidentally got duplicated. What does that mean? What does it mean that you have some extra genes or that you have a huge missing piece of DNA over here? Let's look at this and try to figure out what it means for you.
Can you fly through this data set in some way that's visually interesting?
Yeah, there are lots of powerful tools now that you can use to look at your genome in different ways. I mean, you can zero in just on cool little variants that you might have at one position. And you can, there's sort of actually kind of a Wikipedia that some people use now where you just punch in some information and see, well, what variant do you have at that particular position? Or you can sort of surf around from chromosome to chromosome with some other tools. So they're still kind of in the development phase. I mean, it's not quite Google Maps, but we're getting there.
Finally, is this a snapshot of your genome at this age? And if we were to do this when you were 80 years old, would it be fundamentally different?
Well, I suppose if you looked at some of my cells, they actually would have a different genome because as our cells divide, some of them mutate. And that's what's called mosaicism, and that's actually really important to understanding certain kinds of diseases. The other thing is that the way my genome works is actually controlled by something called – sometimes scientists call the epigenome, and that changes over time too. And I'm actually hoping to take a look at my epigenome over, say, the course of a year. That might be my next project.
Game of Genomes is a three-part series that STAT has published. It's basically Carl Zimmer's personal journey through his own personally sequenced DNA genome. Thanks so much, Carl.
Thank you.
We let it die down. Another black man dead.
Be human.
We let it die down. Another black man dead.
Talk about it.
How many more? How many more?
What can we do to counteract the forces of violence and intolerance and hopelessness that sow the seeds of anger and isolation, leading to the shootings and demonstrations last week? Can this crisis bring people together, allow us to recognize that we have more in common than we might think in our day-to-day lives? That's what people in the Brooklyn neighborhood of Red Hook experienced back in 2012 after Hurricane Sandy obliterated businesses, homes, and infrastructure. Like Hurricane Katrina in New Orleans, Sandy highlighted the gross inequalities street to street in Red Hook as some neighborhoods bounced back quickly while public housing neighborhoods lost power and water for weeks. Years after the recovery, the Falcon Works Theater Company created a theater piece telling stories of a neighborhood fighting to survive, to express what it had experienced and how it crossed barriers it never realized the people in that neighborhood could cross. Three of the young actors, 17-year-old Chance Dixon, 13-year-old Mateo Vidals, and 11-year-old Dante McCoy Freeman, will never forget Sandy and what it taught them about their right not to be left behind.
This theater piece helped me because it made me express feelings that I didn't want to express, but in the good way, because it got the stress off my chest, like making me feel like it was a bad thing, like, and I felt like I couldn't do anything about it. But spreading that word to the community about what we was doing made me feel much better.
How did that happen? Explain what it is you were able to say and how the theater piece worked. Like, what kind of stories did you tell?
We told the story how basically the water, how people reacted towards the water. And when the water was coming, what did people do? Did people stay? Did people leave? And basically that was what the play was explaining.
People of different classes or different races or things like that, they did different things. They took different precautions mm-hmm. because maybe they had a little bit more money. Maybe they had some family or friends that, you know, their house they could stay at to stay away from the storm or any flood zone areas. So I think that the story covers everybody's method of trying to deal with this problem that everybody's in.
Did it show how hard it is to unlock feelings from something like that?
Yeah, I would say it challenged me a bit. It definitely brought out a lot of emotions during the first play. It made me realize what I actually went through, because during Sandy, I kind of saw it as like, I'm just going through this, I'm going to take it day by day, but I never actually realized what happened and like as a whole. And definitely during the play, that made me realize like what I actually went through.
Can you remember any of the lines, the powerful lines from the play, whatever you remember most?
There's a line that Beatrice says. She was in her basement and people just started showing up saying, what do you need us to do? And then she goes on, and we all huddle around her, and just like a big group, and she says about how she felt this real deep compassion and like feeling for her community and like the togetherness. And I think that really touched me and felt like it connected with me with like what happened.
I think one was the actor, his name is Lewis, and he played my father in the play, but he basically, one of his lines was how, I don't remember word for word, but I can describe what it says, or what he says. And basically, he was talking about how basically most of the people in need were colored Black and Latino folks and just waiting in the projects for some supplies and formula, and baby formula. And he was talking about how the people that in need were in the projects and they didn't get as much help as they needed. That really touched me because that was, it was true. The people in the projects, after Sandy hit, for 3-4 days, nobody really helped them. Until they had started having the community meetings and stuff. Other than that, nobody really helped the community.
Who helped you in the end? What were they like? Where did they come from?
All in the end, people helped. Like, they was coming from different places. Like, people from Bay Ridge was coming. Like, different places. Like, different places around the world, people were coming to help other people and to see if they was okay.
Did you have that sense of community?
Yes.
From the experience and from this play, Chance?
From the play. But it was me and my mom and her boyfriend. We were very, like, solo dolo. Like, we're cool with the neighbors, but it's really, like, high and by kind of, you know. The only people in the neighborhood that I really, like, I'm tight with is, like, Falconworks and some people from RHI. Like, that's my peoples. But, we didn't really talk much because what the play shows is that everybody's got their own grind. Everybody's got their own hustle that they needed, you know, they need to fix their life again. Yeah. So there's not really time for, hey, what's going on? You know, like, it's real. And I feel like the play has made me see the whole situation a little less biased. I was very like, oh, these people, they have money, they get the supplies, and it's no problem for them, or they got this privilege and things like that. But, you know, maybe they do, or, you know, it's arguable. But, like, I feel like the trauma is way greater than any system, any
race,
privilege,
or
any race, any thing that you may have, or you have a car, like, you have money, you have this house. It's the fact that it happened is really devastating, and it'll take a toll on a person with
no matter how much money you have,
that's what went down.
Do you think it's important for you to have this sense that you can feel a community? I mean, Falconworks is a community.
Yeah.
I mean, those are your...
It's like a family.
Yeah.
Falconworks is basically a family of people that know what happened.
And this young, to learn that, what do you think it means?
I think it's a great thing. And it's better to learn about it now than to learn about it later.
And also, if you have more people, the message gets bigger and it gets out there. People have more power than other people. You know, maybe this person has more power or more resources or connections than me, but I'm cool with this person. I love this person. This person loves me. So if I say, hey, this is what's going on over here, I have this group of people. Can I get in touch with this group of people? Can we go here and talk about
it?
You know,
race is not a barrier.
No.
Money is not a barrier.
It shouldn't be.
Geography is not a barrier.
Well, it is a barrier. There's people out there who make it a barrier.
Yeah,
but it shouldn't
but
be a barrier,
be
and
all.
We should teach people that there are no barriers.
And that's what you learned.
Yeah,
because the water didn't care.
No.
Do you think you'll ever recover, Mateo?
I'll recover, but I'll always remember it.
And what do you think this theater piece did to help you as a young person?
See Sandy as a whole. See Sandy for what it was.
I think that we, as Falconworks, at least started a conversation.
Definitely.
With the play. Educating everybody about what's going on is helpful. And also, it can help with future disasters and how to deal with that later.
When there's floods, you need plywood. You need
generators.
You need sandbags. Mm-hmm. You need theater.
I think art is the most powerful weapon.
Yeah, it is. Art, your mind, and your intelligence is something that nobody can take away from you.
And art can make you see things in a different way. It can make you understand things better. It'll probably open up wounds, but
it'll heal it
at
the same time.
I think it'll help you see your wounds.
Yeah.
Hmm. And then know, okay, now I have to heal. Now I got to work on this.
Thanks, Chance, Dante, Mateo.
Yeah,
it's been great talking to you.
Thank you. This was cool.
It was great talking to you, too.
Chance Dixon, Mateo Vidals, and Dante McCoy Freeman, actors from the Falcon Works Brooklyn Theater Company. We leave you with these words from poet Walt Whitman, who more than a century ago tried to reconcile the differences of people, their suspicions, their hatreds, and tried with words to bring us all together in America. Unscrew the locks from the doors, he wrote. Unscrew the doors themselves from their jams. Whoever degrades another degrades me, and whatever is done or said returns at last to me. Through me the wind surging and surging, through me the current and index. I speak the password primeval. I give the sign of democracy. By God, I will accept nothing which all cannot have their counterpart of on the same terms. Equality, folks. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Public Radio International.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, the New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.